Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Who better to capture the essence of New York in today's times than New Yorkers themselves? Journalist Craig Taylor immersed himself into the crowded streets of New York, speaking to over 200 everyday people, letting their words paint the picture of contemporary New York. Today, we discuss some of the 75 characters in his new book, as well as Craig's own research into the city and its people. His stories illustrate what makes a New Yorker, why people are drawn there, why some stay when they say they want nothing more than to leave, and how the city, in his own words, became very dark in March 2020. Let me tell you a little about Craig, and we'll bring him right on. Craig Taylor is the author of the best-selling Londoners, Return to Aikenfield, and 1 Million Tiny Plays About Britain. His writings appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, The Globe and Mail, and McSweeney's. Craig Taylor's latest book is New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time. And here is my guest, Craig Taylor. Craig Taylor, welcome, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Very pleased to have you. I love your book. I love the stories in here. And there's so much to talk about. I want to dive straight into this because you're from a seaside village in Western Canada. You moved to New York January 2014 to begin work on this book. So let's start with the why. Why you wanted to write a book about New Yorkers. What was compelling to you about that?
Well, I'd been living in London for 13 years, and I wrote a book called Londoners, in which I interviewed hundreds of Londoners, and it was such a fascinating way of getting to know all of these people who slipped by me on escalators and in the streets. And I was given the chance to go to New York and speak to New Yorkers, and I thought, at this stage in my life, at any point in life, how could you turn down the opportunity to go and listen to, you know, just hundreds of these fascinating people? So I jumped at the opportunity.
Yeah, and so your goal was to capture the voice of contemporary New York, but I read that when you first went out there, you immersed yourself into the works of some well-known older writers who wrote about New York, E.B. White, Joseph Mitchell, for example, and part of you wish you'd been there earlier to capture that older days.
Yeah, I think there's always this sense of New York having, you know, a heyday that you just missed, that you just didn't make it there for. And of course I fell in love with all of these old versions of New York, some of which are very romanticized, but you could go up decade by decade and really yearn to be a part of what New York was. But part of me being there in 2014 onwards was this feeling that, you know, this was my New York, this is the New York that I got, and it was not a shadow of what it once was. It was the opposite of that. It was populated by these extraordinary people, and they were the ones that happened to be there at the same time I was there. And so even the greats, you know, even the terrific New York writers didn't get a chance to speak to these individuals. And I thought that was a saving grace in a way.
Right, right. So let's look at the book itself, New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time. You immersed yourselves on the streets, observing, listening. As you said, you wanted to just absorb it all. You talked with close to 200 New Yorkers. This is 6 years you spent on this, 71 notebooks, 400 hours of tape, and 75 people actually made it into the book. But I'm curious how this began for you. It sounds as though a monumental task here, but it sounds as though it was very organic to you.
Absolutely, and it has to be. You can't really approach a city like New York and impose your own schematic on it. You can't say, this is the theme that I want to find in it. The idea was to just go and speak to people and see what arose. That said, I was working with a list of verbs that I have that I can apply to to places like New York. So cleaning New York and policing New York and even dreaming New York, verbs that are both very practical and some that are somewhat abstract. And so those verbs were what helped me on days when, frankly, I was feeling despondent, when I didn't know where to start or I didn't know who to speak to. I would just choose a word, a verb, and find someone who was enacting that verb. And in talking about action, it meant that they were not sort of musing on the city, but saying something very, very definite about it. I think of the elevator repairman who, you know, talked about the specifics of his job, but in doing so, said some really general and wonderful things about the city itself, too.
Right. I love that idea. I might steal that from you, Craig.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Grabbing a verb. I do often, if I'm stuck on something, I'll come up with a short sentence or something. But I like that, actually going with a verb. So, and I did read in an interview that you did that this is a type of work that should only be done in person. You know, so many people today do interviews, you know, via email for this kind of thing, which I think always tells because it lacks something. So for you, why does that have to be done in person?
There's just no other way. There are some New York writers, especially these days, who Google, you know, their way through the city, and to each his own. But what is happening when you're with a person is a kind of improv that is unique to the situation, and you're creating something together. And really, you know, that can only be done when you are paying attention to someone, letting them have space to talk, letting them go where they want to go. This is not the kind of journalism that's popular these days, and it is very hard to do projects where you have space to just be with people for a long time. And I'm always incredibly grateful that I have stumbled upon this way of putting books together, because it yields great things, and people can speak at length, and they can go on tangents, and they can get interrupted, and they can just sort of venture where they may in the city, and that to me has always yielded good things, and it can only happen when you're there looking at a person and being with them.
Right, and when you're capturing that moment in time, I mean, you're doing a great service because, you know, you're capturing part of history and the feel that's going on right then. So how did you get this project?
I work with an editor who's a very close friend and is an incredibly patient and talented editor who sifts through hundreds of thousands of pages, and his name is Matt Weiland. He works at Norton. He's one of a kind. And after we worked on Londoners together, I had a bunch of ideas, and I think at one point he sort of slyly looked at me and said, "How do you feel about New York?" And I thought, like, how could I say no? And so that was, you know, that's what led me down that road. And I just love the idea of showing up in New York with a project like this. It felt like I just had this secret mission day after day to head out to these corners that I'd never seen.
Yeah. And a couple of quotes I want to look at that you have in the book, they kind of illustrate the feel that you were going for when sharing the stories in New Yorkers. You write that you kept coming back to something an ex-cabbie told you, and that was the people are the texture of New York. Why did that keep pulling you back?
Well, you can write about infrastructure, you can write about government, you can write about all of these, you can write about the New York in the abstract and its buildings, but again and again, I was told by people, including Zach, the cab driver, that, you know, there is a texture of person in New York. There is every type of person. There is every kind of American. You can go to Staten Island and find, you know, the rightest of the right wing. You can go elsewhere and find someone on the polar opposite, and every integer in between. So I really, really came to believe that you know, the city provided this texture, and I loved what the street photographer said about his job, where, you know, he just viewed New York as this incredibly generous place that was constantly giving up what you couldn't find elsewhere. And the nanny who talks about, you know, the concept of the other and how whoever you are, there is your other in a place like New York, and how that can, you know, change a person for the better and change a person's view of the world. Mm-hmm. So the generosity of the place was something that was just always apparent to me.
I loved It was in the very first part of the book. There were two stories about the blind man with his dog, and he was talking about the smell and how everybody has their own smell, and he couldn't get a sense of one woman because she wore nothing that was perfumed. And the sounds, of course, you know, and he didn't like walking through construction areas because he couldn't hear. So he's seeing it one way, and then you talk with a photographer and he's telling a whole different way of looking at the city through his lens. I just love those two stories, and you know, they were very told very close together, so they didn't quite follow on, but they almost did.
Yeah, and Frank Sr., who is a blind singer in New York, is an incredible individual, and he could almost have told the entire history of modern New York through the smells, and he captures a little bit. There's one part where he talks about the smell of Times Square in the 70s and 80s.
Yes,
he had a newsstand right there, and it just made me think that, you know, this whole city can be told, the history can be told in these different ways, and there is a history of smell and sound in the city, how voices have changed, how accents have changed. He talks about hearing people smacking down dominoes on the stoops, you know, and that sound sort of drifted away. So I really loved this way that each individual had their own prism and was looking at the city through that prism. The photographer's was obviously more visual, and he was able to talk about just the faces and the plasma between people, the kind of hidden, invisible substance that binds everyone together, which I always loved.
Yeah, the smell is such a strong recollection. To this day, I still remember this. When I smell ant spray, I am transported back to when I was 11 years old in a boarding school in French, and there was an invasion of ants in the dormitory. But it's
so powerful. And the woman you mentioned who has no smell, there's this idea of a kind of ghostliness that goes through the book. And so you have these figures that seem like ghosts in a way, and I loved that a ghost to Frank is someone with no scent.
Right. One of the things I loved was that you really, by the way these stories are told, we get a real sense of humanity. And there was a lady from El Salvador who came here illegally many years ago as a child, and she relayed some of that. Of course, the story of Joe. I wonder if you'd share a little about Joe with our listeners and how you connected with him.
So Joe is an individual who I met while working on Sundays at a meal that served at a church on 16th Street. I just sort of stumbled upon it and came back there most Sundays and was introduced to a gentleman who was homeless at the time, was a Vietnam vet, and he too sees New York through this very specific prism. I found that New York was like a power that really elevated some people and rewarded some people, but it did have a punitive edge, and getting to know Joe very intimately in a way, I got to see how it can be a very hard place for people and how it contains so much. And for him, it was a place of penance and pain. But that said, he's an incredible survivor. He's an incredible person that knows the city like no other. And he became a very close friend. He's a very, complex individual, but we had, as outsiders in a way to the city, a very meaningful time together. And so that thread of our friendship kind of goes throughout the book and ends us, you know, it takes us to the end as well.
Right, right. One of the things that kind of stuck with me was you asked him what he heard as people passed by him. And he said, you hear everything. And once he'd been lying there and someone said, is that even a person? And he does talk about, you know, how he loves the openness and of nature and everything. Why do you think he did not leave New York?
I think it's a, you know, it's a question that echoes through the book. He obviously has his reasons, from deep and personal reasons. The effect of PTSD on him is profound. I'd never witnessed something like that before, and I think there's a legacy now in the United States of men who have been hurt in this way and carry with them a sense of pain and guilt. But this idea of not knowing when to leave New York and if they can leave New York, it wasn't just seen in people who have been hurt in that way, But I saw it with the therapist who told me that lots of her clients talk about leaving. Should they leave? Should they stay? So for so many people all across the spectrum, New York was this force that they dealt with and grappled with, and would leaving New York be a defeat? Would it finally bring happiness? Would it be something that was possible? All of these questions seem to be constantly asked in New York by the people I ran into.
There's a certain comfort I find in the anonymity of a big city. I grew up in a big city and I like that anonymity. There's a sense of belonging and yet not belonging. And yet Joe said that even though he didn't know people, they knew him.
Yeah, he was a fixture of sorts at this on this one block in Park Avenue. He was there every night, and I think, you know, people recognized him, and he was sort of a figure in the lives of some of the employees in the hotels nearby, and there are these makeshift communities that pop up and sustain different people, and that helps break through some of that anonymity sometimes. I think everybody there, I certainly felt it, just wanting to be in enough of a community that if I needed to break through anonymity, I could. But at the same time, enjoying what you've described, that sense of being in a city and not being beholden and being anonymous as well.
Right. So Tom Wolfe, I think you mentioned this in the book, said that one belongs to New York City instantly. A lot of people don't feel that way. What do you think makes the difference with someone?
Yeah, I loved these slightly, usually made by white guys, pompous statements about New York, defining
right.
it in this way. And because then you'd have all of these people who would just say, no, you know, I'll never be a New Yorker. Or I'm not interested in being a New Yorker. Or, you know, I'm a Salvadoran. I came here to do a job. There were just so many different ways of reacting to the word New Yorker, and I love leaving it up to the people themselves. One man I interviewed had been there a couple weeks, and he was a New Yorker. He said, like, that's just it. And others just didn't want it, or didn't want to be an American, or didn't want to be tied to a place, or were just frankly too busy. So the idea of the New Yorker and how people reacted to it was fascinating to me.
Mm. What was the most difficult part of hearing people's stories? Was there a particular story that haunted you, that stayed with you?
Well, there's a kind of big ticket resilience that I encountered a lot in New York. So I obviously spoke to people involved with 9/11, including, you know, a man who has been suffering from a degenerative nerve disease since he was on the pile as a first responder, and I saw over the years him, you know, progressively change, and he's a very, you know, proud and strong ex-policeman, but his body was sort of letting go, and that was very hard to see, even though I was taking down these words of resilience from him, and he appears in the book as quite a resilient figure. But that story, the COVID story, the COVID section, which is lengthy in the book, is always emotional to me because one of the people in the book, Dan Bousso, who's a lawyer out in Queens, he was a big part of the book before, and then last year caught COVID and went into the hospital, and things were very serious for him, and he tells his story in a way only he can, of sitting down, putting a chair across from him, and addressing the chair like it's the virus, and in effect saying, what do you think you're doing? You think you can come to New York? You think you can take this city away from me? These are very, still to me today, these are very moving stories that people shared with me. And so I just hope some of that comes across in the book. It's a book of a history of emotion in a way, rather than a straight up history of the city.
Yeah, I felt you could hear people's voices as I was reading, which is a great attribute. So one of the things that I read in an interview was that it's coming out in an audiobook, or maybe it has come out in an audiobook.
Yes, the audiobook was released this week on publication, and I've heard some of it, and I had asked them to ensure that they used a lot of different actors, a lot of different backgrounds, so that the people matched up in a way, and I think they've done a good job, so... Yeah, I'm keen to listen to the rest of it.
Mm. And so going back to pandemic days, you said, you write that March 2020, the city became very dark. What was it like being there? I mean, I can't imagine it's, you know, it happened here in Washington, where we are, of course, Seattle, but I'm kind of in an isolated area. I can't imagine being in the middle of a massive city with the dense population when we realized what was happening.
I think it was the first time I'd found that a sense of living in history as it changed, and each day, especially in March of 2020, it seemed that something changed. The behavior on the sidewalks changed. Then the next day, the restaurants closed down. Then the next day, I witnessed, you know, screaming matches in Central Park when people were walking too close. It just felt like each day there was an added element. The hospital ship pulled up next to Manhattan. So by the time that I had to leave because the Canadian border was closing, it had been a month of just a crescendo of anxiety. And for those who were there for the next months, I mean, that crescendo only got louder.
Yeah. One of the things you say is that you were surprised by how many of the people you spoke with felt they could teach you something, whether that was how to recycle cans, steal a car, or something more profound. And I'm wondering, you talk about you learned how to be more compassionate. Share what you learned about that, would you?
Yeah, I think there was a surface level of lessons. I mean, it's surprise that New Yorkers would want to, you know, endlessly teach me, like, where to get the best bagels and how to do this and how to do that and which express train. And oh, there were all of these practical pieces of knowledge. But what I noticed as the project went on was that there was a lot of, you know, deeper, more human advice passed on by these extraordinary people. And I think for me, one of the individuals I became close with is a man named Ralph Martin, who works at the welcome table at this meal and hands out tickets and just seemed to personify some of the great traits of a New York compassion that is not sickly sweet, but is deeply, deeply involved in the lives of the people around him. And I think at the end he just says that, you know, there's nothing more important than compassion. It's the only thing that matters in life. And if there's one thing that living in a place like New York has taught him over these years, it's that it's a place where you can enact that, where you can test your sense of compassion, where you can be that kind of person and be tested and grow, you know, in a way that maybe you couldn't elsewhere. So I learned a lot from people like him.
Yeah, I have to say I found New Yorkers so friendly the first time I went there. I was shocked. I was really shocked because you hear so much, so many stories. What did you learn about living artfully?
Well, there's a sense of just knowing what to do and when to do it and what to eat and what, you know, what dish to order. There's a sense of specificity that especially the born and bred New Yorkers had that I just thought was incredible. There was, you know, this long list of exactly how to do certain things, and you did it, you know, there's from the beginning to the end of your life. And there's a woman at the beginning of the book who talks about food and her definite food choices. And then at the end of the book, there's a hospice nurse who talks about spending time with New Yorkers as they're nearing the end of their lives. And they still, you know, they still want certain dishes from Zabar's. They still want, you know, certain meals. They still want to go to certain places. And I just love this artful way of living, cultivating a way of life that was just so meaningful and seemed to cut out some of the stuff that the rest of us have to do.
Right. I want to look at a couple of quotes, Craig. You say most people said it is a playground for the rich, which I kind of felt when I was there. You'd have to be quite wealthy to have a really great life out there. And part of living in New York is just mourning the hell out of it, which we could argue that about life in general these days, I think.
Yeah.
So would you just comment on those quotes, what they mean to you?
Yeah, I think from my time in London, I realized that when people wanted to show me that they knew London in a way that was profound, they would describe how to get somewhere, you know, in the curvy streets, and they would know exactly the directions. And that seemed to be, you know, a way of describing your knowledge of London. And in New York, it seemed that you showed that you were so knowledgeable about the city by telling someone what these buildings used to be, what these shops used to be. So you were aware, you know, in the grid of Manhattan, not so much about the streets, but about what was there and what was there before, and all of these kind of ghostly remembrances that showed to people around you the depth of your knowledge. So that's, you know, that was the first one. And sorry, what was the other quote?
The other one was, part of living in New York is just mourning the hell out of it, which is just a playground for the rich.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I heard again and again and again was about the rich and about the real estate disease that was taking over the city, or has taken it over, the way that everyone is being pushed out. And then the life that the rich had in New York, I was able to talk not to the super rich, but to the people who served the super rich. So a member of the personal staff of one man and the nanny of the super rich, of a sommelier, you know, these people that knew what was going on in the lives of the rich. And it's becoming, you know, a place where they are welcomed, where others are not. But I didn't ever get the sense that their New York was always that pleasurable, you know. I think the recording studio engineer describes a New York that's just full of Apple stores and Michael Kors stores, and it's full of people wandering around looking for a history that's not there, and that's just not the kind of city you want, and certainly not the kind of incarnation of New York anyone wants.
Yeah, we don't want our big cities to become homogenized like everywhere. I mean, they are becoming more so every day, and I think that's terribly sad, because, you know, when you go to Europe, it used to be the coin and the, you know, the bills were different, and it's all that difference that I think makes life interesting.
Yeah, and there's definitely a kind of nowhere New York that rises up to meet you wherever you go, where it's just the same Duane Reade, it's the same Bank of America,
right,
the same again and again. And I could get a sense from those who were mourning what had come before that a lot of this kind of deforestation had happened within their lifetimes. Who wouldn't mourn that?
Absolutely. Since you wrote the book Londoners before this one, I'm sure you made some comparisons in what some things that I read that you said New Yorkers challenged me in a way that Londoners never did, and London insinuated like damp New York hit.
Yeah, I think that comes from living there too. I was just, you know, I was there living my life in London for so long before I wrote Londoners, and it arose out of a much longer process, an organic process of just being in the city. So yeah, I always think of that as my London experience. But that's not actually a bad thing, because, you know, I'll take London's cool dampness over that kind of sticky New York summer any day. But you know, people are people generally, and you're going to find, you know, a huge variety of individuals in both cities. They're both truly global cities. But I guess what I loved about New York was just the sense of velocity, the way people spoke, their willingness to forego reticence and just dive into self-mythology, which was a bit different than my experience in London. It took a bit longer to draw people out in London. And you know, New York people are just ready to go. If they're going to talk to you, they've got a bit of time, and they're going to talk fast and
right.
Get it done.
Right. So since you came up with a verb when you were going out searching for your stories and characters, I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you for a verb, if you can nail it down to one, to describe New York. When you think in retrospect now of New York, what would that verb be?
Just absorbing. I think that is the big thing. I always thought of it as this power that you, if you put up a fight, it's always going to best you. But if you sort of absorb it and let it come in and guide you, you know, you will be taken towards experiences that you could never have anywhere else. And just absorb. That's what I miss the most, is absorbing the proximity to people that I would never come into contact with. I mean, cities like New York are just providers. You will see people, you will see sights, clothing, hairstyles, whatever, that you will never see anywhere else. And it's just there in proximity to you day after day. And there's just no other experience. It's such a you absorb and you're kind of widened by it. You become a better, hopefully different person by the experience.
Yeah, well, the book is really enjoyable to read, and I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at craigdtaylor.com. The book, again, is New Yorkers, is City and Its People in Our Time. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Craig? I have to let you go, and I could talk to you for hours here.
First of all, thank you for such a deep reading of the book. It's so great to speak to someone who's actually really engaged with the book. I guess my final thought is just one of resilience. I'd love to just let the listeners know that that's kind of at the core of the book. That I remember there was one New York guy who said to me, you know, sure, I'd leave New York if something really bad happened, you know, something really, really bad happens, but, you know, a pandemic, a terrorist attack, a financial crisis, a blackout, a hurricane.
Right.
Something really bad, not those, but something really bad. And I thought, that's great. It's always a trade-off being there. You're always giving something up. But for those who stick it out, it's an incredible life.
Yeah, and, you know, resilience, I've talked with loads of psychiatrists and psychologists, they all say resilience is at the core of being really happy. So that's a great trait to have.
There you go, yeah.
Well, Craig Taylor, pleasure talking with you today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for interviewing me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.